Before we dive in today, I want to let you know a few ways you can support the podcast. The biggest one by far is word of mouth. If you enjoy this and you know other Stephen King fans, please tell them about it. Share the episodes on social media. It really does help. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Chat Cemetery. There are links to those in the show notes. And if you are really dedicated to the show, you can become a Patreon supporter where I will have bonus episodes going up. I am covering all of the Stephen King related comics over on Patreon. So there's definitely going to be a lot more bonus content coming this year. And now let's get into the episode. Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back, as is Katie Schaefer. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today we're talking all about the Under the Dome TV show, unfortunately. And, you know, it started off okay, but the big thing about this show, Katie, is how much it strays from the book.
Oh God, so much. It's like they took a couple of ideas from it and then just made it their own. In a way that I don't think they really should. Like, I think the thing, and I messaged you about this, was that Stephen King said that the writers just weren't able to build the supports to make this story work. And when I read that, I was like, yep, that's it exactly.
And here's the thing. I absolutely love a lot of Brian K. Vaughan's work, and he was very involved in the show. Give me Why the Last Man. I will read that comic more than once. I haven't read it more than once just yet, but I probably will at some point. And to see a creator's name attached to it, who I've enjoyed so much, and then to not enjoy this as much was fairly disappointing. But I know we want to talk about the differences between the book and the show, of which there are many, before we dive into sort of season by season stuff. But I think the big thing is this book wasn't really a sci-fi book.
No.
In the way that they tried to make this a sci-fi show. You know, this book was very much about the town. And it's kind of like how, yes, there are vampires in Salem's Lot, but the story is very much about the town, not solely focused on vampires existing, you know?
Or like The Mist.
Right.
Like The Mist story is totally about the conflicts of people trapped in a small space. And this is like that taken, you know, to a huge degree. And that for me was the interesting thing about the story. It wasn't like why the dome is there isn't really that big of a deal to me. It's the what's going on with all of these characters that he's built up for us.
Yeah, and I do think the show did some okay things with certain characters. And it wasn't necessarily the fact that they changed some of the characters. It was the fact that they just went completely off the rails with the story. And I was like, wait, this was not what I was expecting at all. And I will say this. I think if you want to watch this, watch the first season. And then maybe the finale, series finale.
Oh, gosh.
Although if you do that, I'm not sure you will understand how they got from the end of season one to that series finale.
Nope.
But I think season one was worth watching. Season two was like, okay. And then season three, you're just like, what is going on? Nobody knows.
Yes. And Under the Dome, the book, is a long one. It's what? It's almost 1,000, isn't it?
I think my copy was almost 1,100 pages.
So a lot of stuff happens in that book. Like an insane amount of things happen. That is nothing compared to the first season of this show. Like it is taking twist after turn. And I was just like, am I watching Days of Our Lives right now? Like it was... Especially with all of the, like, my personal favorite that felt the most soap opera-y was Junior's character and Big Jim's character. Because Junior, I swear to God, he has to go back and forth that, like, he's going to kill his dad. Oh, no, he loves his dad and is going to save him. He's going to kill his dad, like, 6-7 times. It's just like, pick a side, man. Pick a side.
And Junior's one of the characters they changed a lot about in the story, too, because him and his father both are not remotely likable in the book. But I feel like with Junior, what they really wanted to do was Well, obviously, one, they were like, we're going to cast this attractive person, so you'll find it very hard to be that mad at him.
And even though he's doing the creepiest shit. Yeah.
Yeah. But as the story progresses, he has a switch, and you're kind of like, okay, I guess he's not that bad, but it still doesn't excuse anything he did in season one. But the way they wrote the character, they were like, we really want you to like this guy.
Yes, he wants to be like a redeemable anti-hero. And it's so, for me, it was so hard to separate that junior character from the book. And to be clear, like the junior character in the book is pretty complicated because he's got a brain tumor. So he's not in control of himself for the vast majority of the book. From the first moment we see him, he's already losing it. So that makes him sympathetic, even though he does terrible, terrible things. And in this, it's just, he just seems so wishy-washy.
Yeah. And even though what he does isn't nearly as terrible as it is in the book, you're just like, eh.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I guess, you know, with all King books, when you're adapting it to a film or a TV show, they're not going to be able to show the graphic stuff. And in all Stephen King books, even the most not horror-y sci-fi ones, there is always some really graphic, horrible shit going on. And certain stuff I was like, yeah, that wouldn't have worked in the show. Like the horrific rape scene that happens in the book. Glad that's not in the show. Don't want to see that. They could not have pulled it off as okay enough as King does in the book. But eventually, I think the third episode in, I was just like, okay, we're just going to completely separate myself out from my feelings of how much I liked the book versus what I'm feeling about this show and just detach all my, and try at least to detach my connections to these characters, because these people on the TV show are not the characters from the book.
Right. Plus, we should mention that this aired on CBS originally, which it's always very interesting to me what Stephen King properties end up on, you know, like these big network channels. Given the content of most of his stories, it's like, okay, you can't do a lot of these things right. on CBS. I mean, it's weird because Law & Order SVU definitely exists, and it's definitely having a lot of these conversations, but they don't necessarily get as gritty and in-depth as King does in his descriptions of these kinds of things happening. In SVU, they handle it in a much different way than King would when writing a novel, and obviously that's by design because that show is for TV and has been on TV for, oh, I don't know, it's on like season 21 or 22 yep. or something.
The most egregious things to me were the changing of Julia and Big Jim. The Barbie character I also really didn't like, but Julia Shumway like loses so much of her, what makes her an interesting and unique character and just kind of makes her a very stock, oh, this is a beautiful, smart, confident lady. She can do all the things, whereas she's much more abrasive and intense and no-nonsense in the book. And Big Jim is just like a totally different person. And I don't know if he's necessarily more realistic or less, but he's definitely not as interesting a character and not nearly as menacing. And I think that's mostly because the show doesn't make him the villain.
Right. And with Julia Shumway, I think the actress who plays her, whose name I will probably butcher because I believe it is French, and it's Rachelle Lefevre. I don't know if that's correct. I don't know how you do V's in French.
Lefevre.
Okay. There we go. Thank you.
A French pronunciation that Americans can't speak.
I can't do it. I'm the worst with name pronunciations. But I feel like she at least does as much as she can with what she's given with Julia.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But the big change that is revealed to us, and we can kind of start diving into season one here, is that she's married. And I was like, huh? Why?
Yeah. Yeah. Why? And she's an outsider from the town. She didn't grow up there. And it's not, and like the newspaper thing isn't a thing in the show, and it's such a pivotal point in the book.
Yeah.
So it was like, what are they gonna do with her? It was kind of my question when I found that stuff out.
Yeah, and her husband's name is Peter, and there's a Peter in the book who is one of the cops and plays a very different character. And I was like, is this supposed to just be like a nod to that character? But he's not really that character because we see him for, what, two scenes?
Yep. Yep.
Pretty much.
And that's what I wrote online, is that they kind of like, oh, we'll just take this character name and this character name and this character name and then just make completely different characters out of them. And they combined a lot of different people. And so it was like, I'm just not feeling it. But I did like season one a lot better than any of the others. I thought season, like by the end of it, I was like, okay, I'm kind of interested here. What's going on? And then season two, it just, what?
I think with season one, I was like, okay, they made changes. I'm kind of intrigued to see how this is going to work because of these changes they made. Like, Rusty was such a huge character for a good chunk of the book, and he's just, right, like, on the other side. He's outside of the dome. And you're like, okay, bye.
Right. And then Linda is the head cop for a while. And I was like, oh, okay. And I ended up liking what they did with Linda's character. I think she's interesting. And that's where they really stretched new ground that, to me, was like, okay, this works for this story. And what they did with Barbie kind of works for the story. But I think with a lot of season one, it was really trying to just get used to these characters as they were and not as what I expected them to be, which is always a problem when you're watching an adaptation of something you really enjoy.
I will say I did like how they handled Joe and Nori, though. I felt like, yes, we got more of them that we didn't necessarily get in the book. Not that the kids weren't a big part of the book, but it felt like they really wanted to make those characters in particular a bigger part of the story, which I didn't mind, because with Rusty being outside of the dome and all of these other changes, you kind of had a feeling that someone was going to have to step up. And the fact that it was Joe and Nori, and, you know, they're these teenagers still trying to figure things out, and now they're trying to figure it out with this giant catastrophe going on. And I just liked how those two characters played off of each other. And that, I think, was part of why I was more intrigued by season one, because I was like, okay, how are all of these different relationships going to play out? Because you can tell in the book that Joe obviously has a crush on Nori, but you don't really get to see that fleshed out in the book.
Right, right. It's just kind of hinted at in these little bits. And I loved that part of the book, and that it gives us a little bit of those kid gang things that King loves to do. And that was so interesting. And I felt like that still kind of stuck around throughout the whole show, in that with Joe and Nori and Angie at first. And I really liked what they did with Angie's character. Because, I mean, the show, like the first episode really starts out very similar to the book. You know, the dome comes down, the plane crashes, and we see Barbie in the beginning, and it feels so similar. And then it kind of immediately, after about the first 15 minutes, just goes off in a crazy place. Because it shows Barbie killing Julia's husband, and we have no idea why. And then it's explained, of course, but
thankfully.
Yeah. Because that really was a huge change. And I'm sure they did that specifically because they wanted it to be like, we're our own thing. We are not the book. And, you know, that's okay. I mean, I liked that we got to see more of some different characters. Like with Phil Bushy, we saw a completely different person who's playing the character named Phil Bushy.
Yeah.
And there's no meth. There's no meth in this. They talk about it.
There's lots of propane.
Yes. Yep. And they talk about it, but like, the costs of the meth and that, or no, they call it something else. I can't remember what they call it. They're making a drug with the liquid propane. Yeah. I was like, nobody's going to make a drug with liquid propane because that's toxic. They mention it, so it's kind of in the background, but it's pretty quickly forgotten. And they move on to having, what, like two catastrophes an episode? It's like two different horrible things are happening in an episode and they have to resolve it.
Yeah. Real quick, I do want to give a shout out to Samantha Mathis, who plays one of Nori's moms. She plays Alice. She has been in Salem's Lot and Nightmares and Dreamscapes. So this is her third King adaptation. And I was like, oh, you look familiar. Oh, this is why.
Yep, I noticed that too. I was like, I've seen that lady several times before. And I think, those two were honestly my favorite characters. Both of her moms were just so down to earth and reasonable and felt very, like, very real characters. And that was so satisfying. And the fact that they introduced that was a pretty big deal, because that has no place in the book. There are no, you know, there's no minorities or queer people represented in the book at all. And they make, and King makes a point to talk about that, and that this is such a small town that it's still all white and straight. And there's actually quite a, you know, in the book, there's a lot of internalized homophobia with some of the characters. But, and I liked that there are several people of color who are in this show, and it really pushes those boundaries and isn't afraid to do that. Because in the, it, this is not a situation where any of that matters, and it's far more interesting if you have a wider variety of people playing the characters. Like Dodie. I thought Dodie's character and her acting was really interesting, and I liked what they did with her.
It was funny because, you know, Dodie was finding all of those signals, so to speak, in the radio station. And, you know, I was watching this and I was like, why does she look so familiar? And I realized she was in WandaVision. She was like one of the background, like, town people.
That's right.
I was like, oh, this is why I just saw her. And that happened with a lot of the cast. I think this was very much a TV cast of the time, because all of these people, for the most part, were pretty recognizable. I was like, okay, you know, I've seen the people who are playing Julia and Dale and Dodie and, like I said, Alice, so many
Big
of
Jim.
These people. Oh, yeah, Big Jim from Breaking Bad. I was like, yes, okay.
Yeah, this was a show of, hey, it's that guy, or hey, it's that lady.
And I had just watched Lost, too. So even Jeff Fahey just being in, you know, a few episodes, I was like, oh, this is Pleasant. And the characters who would come and go, too, you know, Beth was Aunt Zelda from the Sabrina show.
Oh, God, yes. I love
the first Sabrina show, not the Netflix one.
Yeah, I know who she is. She's great, too. They're both great Zeldas.
Yeah.
Like, I thought, and here's the thing. Is when I am expressing my issues with this show, none of that is towards the acting.
Right. They did what they could.
They did. And all of the points where I was like, ugh, cringe, it was because that was a bad writing line. That line did not work. You failed. But all of the actors are giving it their all, and they're all doing a really good job, especially Julia. And Dean Norris is so, even though he's not nearly as bad a guy, he's still so hateable in this. And especially as the show continues and kind of get some character development. It's really kind of the same character development happening over and over again. Like it is with Junior. Like Junior keeps, he's bad. Oh, and now he's good for a season or an episode. Oh, now he's bad again. And it's like, and it's definitely, for the show's perspective, it's an attempt to give these people some depth. But because it happens so fast, their motivations are in no way supported. And that is really frustrating, and it eventually just became humorous. But I do think the one change with that was Angie. Britt Robertson is Angie McAllister, who dies, what, like, in time-wise, 15 minutes into the book. Like, we never see Angie do anything. And in this, she's really given an opportunity to shine and be an interesting character.
Same with Dodie, too.
Yes. Yep, Dodie dies. Oh, that was bad. Both at Junior's hand.
Yeah. And I want to ask you about two things in particular with this first season. First, we have the mini dome. Second, we have the whole butterfly storyline. Thoughts on those?
Okay, so the butterfly storyline, like that, I found good. Get a little science in it, and that makes sense. And it definitely foreshadows what's coming later with the dome. And it's interesting, but it never really nails anything down for any of the characters. Until we get to the point of season two where there's more ramifications for all the butterflies. But the mini dome with the egg. And this is where a lot of my personal issues with the show start. Is when it really dips into that sci-fi, which it doesn't do until like episode 8 or 9 of the show. It really misses the mark for me. Like the mini dome, and then, oh, we put our hands on it and it's the thing powering the dome and all of this. I was like, this is really complicated and not clearly explained. And they take far, far too long to really get down to what's going on.
Both you and I have made it pretty clear that King's alien stories haven't necessarily been our favorite. And I think of them, you know, Under the Dome technically still falls into that category, but because it wasn't focused or centered on the aliens necessarily, it yeah. works so much better. But then in this, they're like, now we're going to do the alien thing.
Yeah. And like the alien thing really works in the book. I think that's his best usage of it because it's really more of it's more of an allegory that then ties into the rest of what he's been showing with this story. So it works really well for me, not for everybody for sure. But I think in the show, it was hog wild crazy with the sci-fi stuff. And it was it really detracted from the thing I liked about the original story, which was the character interactions. It does give a lot of opportunity, like the sci-fi elements that they explore do give a lot of opportunity for conflict. You know, it's not just related around, because in the book, the dome is an inert thing. In this, the dome is reacting to them. It's apparently talking to them. It's making choices and punishing them for things. And it's just like, okay, this is a little, I either need a lot more explanation or none at all. Because the little bits you're getting are just making it more confusing at that point.
Yeah. I will give this show some credit, though, for having some fun set pieces. I really liked the look of the town overall. I loved the diner.
Yes, yes. That felt so good.
I did like the radio station because it was, like, not in a typical building. It's like they were going up and all the yes. stairs, and then it wasn't like a water tower necessarily, but it's like the radio version of a water tower almost.
Right. Combined with a church where it's like they've put everything up at the top of the steeple type situation. And it's just, I liked that too. I liked getting more from the radio station because then it felt like it gave a little more context to the town's perspective, like the town as a character as opposed to individual members of the town. The radio station provides that background of what everybody else is thinking, which we get in the book through little tidbit scenes from random people. And I think that worked really well. I think that was a great choice on their part to make the radio station be a much bigger part of it as opposed to just kind of some background noise.
And I think that goes to show how important local radio stations are, especially in small towns like Chester's Mill. And that's a source of not only news, but entertainment, and it's the only one in the area pretty much. I'm sure when the dome was up you could get one from like Castle Rock or something like that, which was not too far away. But overall, season one, I think it did a fairly good job of introducing the characters, even though some introductions were a little clunky, like Barbie, you know, not being yeah. from town, killing Julia's husband, that whole thing I think threw me off with Barbie's character the most out of all the other character changes.
Yes, we never really get the full story of why Junior and Barbie hate each other. Like, it's weird because they retained that part of the book, but we never really, I don't remember, we might have, I just might not remember, but we never seem to really find out why.
I don't know if it's because Barbie has something against Big Jim the whole time, so therefore Junior's like, I hate my dad too, but I don't hate him. So now I hate Barbie. And it's just right. like back and forth and back and forth with Junior. And also, I know this will come into play a little later, but we kind of start to get some backstory in season one with Junior and Big Jim and the fact that the mom has since passed away, which, like I said, to be continued shortly.
Right.
But you really see the tension between those two characters. And I do think they did that well.
Yeah. Even if they didn't give a good explanation, like you get something out of it. That works for me. I don't need everything explained, but it did feel like since they went to the trouble of explaining so much in this show, it's like, why not that part? The other thing I was expecting more of was for the hospital to be a bigger part of things, because it's a pretty integral part of the story, the original story. And it's pretty much just abandoned after the first season. You're like, there might be sick people. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter.
Yeah. Anything else on season one before we move to season two here? I know we're not going super in depth, but I feel like One, if you haven't watched the show, you're probably not going to.
And if you haven't watched the show, if we went in depth with it, you would be like, what the hell are these folks talking about? Because it's, I kid you not, folks, it is like in one episode, there are three different huge conflicts and someone may or may not die and it's a cliffhanger and it's like, what? Why is this even happening? So if you really want to know more about it, you can subject yourself to it.
Or just read Wikipedia and see how confused you are.
Yes, yes. But I think the only other thing was that I was actually pretty hopeful when I watched the end of the first season. I was like, okay, maybe they are going to go some interesting places with this. Because I had not yet given into temptation and just read ahead on the Wikipedia as to what happened. Because I definitely do that sometimes. I was hopeful. I was like, okay, maybe they can really pull this off. I'm not sure how they're going to get three seasons out of it, but interesting. And then I watched the second season, or I watched at least part of the second season.
We have entered the Dwight Yoakam phase.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
We have also entered the bring someone back from the dead phase. Let me tell you, it does not happen in the book.
No. And it works better because of that. I think the second season is where it really starts to go off the rails. It, like, the train is leaning to the side here.
Is there ever a mention of Zenith in the book? Like, what is this?
No. Nope, there's not. The only other towns that are mentioned, I think Derry comes up at least once.
Castle Rock.
Castle Rock. That's the only other town that's really mentioned because that's where the military is stationed. And I think they mentioned the, like,
Tarker's Mill? Isn't there, like, a sister mill town or something?
Yeah, like the three towns around it that are cut.
Morden or something, too.
Yep, but none of them are Zenith. And none of them are, like, are as nearly as big as it's portrayed in the show.
Yeah, and the main thing in Zenith kind of just looks like this big, what, obelisk or something. Yeah. And I'm just like, this is getting very strange. And, you know, that's keeping it mild.
Yeah. Yep. I think for me, the point when I decided, I was like, this has all gone very, very wrong, is when, so they introduce Rebecca, who I think is the first character who isn't in the book at all. And there's no representation for her in the book. She's a science teacher and she's figuring out all the science and she helps solve some of the problems or whatever. And then she goes to, okay, so we don't have enough food. Let's start killing people as a way to save them. And I was like, it's been like 2 weeks, ma'am. This is a little early to do that. And she's just gung-ho about it. And it's two whole episodes and she convinces Jim about it. It was like, You can't just murder folks. You can't. It's not going to work.
Yeah.
And thankfully, they don't end up going that route. But I think that was the point where, for me, it jumped the shark into, like, okay, you're just going to go all over the place.
Yeah. They also finally introduce the town drunk, who does not live in the town, apparently. I mean, he does, but he's, like, off in a cabin by himself. So Eddie Cahill plays Sam Verdureau. You have, like I mentioned, Dwight Yoakam playing Lyle Chumley, which is, I have no words. And then Melanie is the one who comes back from the dead.
Yep. As a teenager and a dead person that nobody in town except a couple of people know, because that happens in, what, the 70s?
Well, because
70s or 80s.
They're the ones who kind of sort of killed her, it turns out.
Yep.
And then we're introduced to Dale's father, Don, who is played by Brett Cullen, and he has this kid, Hunter, working for him, played by Max Eric, I guess is how you pronounce that. That's not how you normally spell Eric, but that's fine.
It's all good. Yeah, and I felt like the characters that were introduced in this weren't entirely necessary, and I think it kind of went against, I mean, not so much the Rebecca and Sam.
Uh-huh.
Like, once they start to go outside, like, the whole point and interesting thing of the concept, not even talking about the original book, the concept of being where the main focus of this story should be on the people who live in this town and they are forced to reckon with this horrible event, and that it doesn't keep the pressure and focus on that fact and the interrelations between these people is where it really starts to fall apart for me, when it relies very heavily on, like, okay, well, let's bring in this outside character to spice things up again, and let's add this weird sci-fi stuff to keep people's interest.
Yeah. As soon as Melanie came out of the middle of the lake, Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, you're just kind of like, what's going on? And then you have the whole weird thing with Sam, because it's clear he sees her and he's like taken aback. And you're like, mm-hmm. okay, what does this mean? And then that slowly, slowly unravels, painfully slow.
Yes. And Sam's actions in the story never really make sense to me. Why he does what he does is just like, there's no logical reason to behave like this.
And the thing is, it kind of takes over this entire season too, or at least a decent chunk of it, because then you have Pauline coming into the picture, who is Junior's mother. And so,
and Jim's ex-wife.
We kind of have two people coming back from the dead. I don't know. Are you an ex-wife if you're dead, or are you just a dead wife?
Yeah.
But she's not dead.
Right. And she was never dead. She was only thought to be dead because reasons. Hate to keep bringing it up back to it, but I got to say, it works so much better that, because it's only mentioned briefly in the book, but Big Jim killed his wife. And he knows that. He suffocates her with a pillow when she's sick. And like, that really speaks to Big Jim's character. And I mean, obviously this is a different character, but yeah, they kind of played fast and loose with Pauline throughout the rest of the series.
It's really crazy where things go from season two. Because at first you're like, okay, they're going to ration the food. They're going to have some more struggles. And then you're like, oh, they're just going to kill everyone, I guess. And it went downhill fast.
Which, I'll tell you, in today's day and age, obviously this was made in 2013, 2014. So it's well before the pandemic. But in today's day and age, when, because how she intends to do it is with a pig virus. I was like, ma'am, you have no idea what you're messing with right now. Immediately. I'm thinking about the current situation with the pandemic. And I was like, they'll never be able to do this storyline again.
Also, let's talk about the fact that this season starts with the fact that they were going to execute Barbie for crimes he was never tried for.
Right. And that happens in the book. In this, like, it gets real close. Like, he is, and I have to point this out, whoever decided that Phil Bushy, one of the few black characters in the show, should be the one to erect the gallows with the lynching, maybe was not a good thoughtful choice.
Yeah. And I mean, Stephen King wrote the first episode of season two.
Oh God. And he's in it. That's where he makes his appearance. And I immediately, it's Stephen King. And my husband's like, I know what Stephen King looks like, honey. It's okay. I'm like, but I'm always excited to see him. Him in his weirdly high voice. I love it.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy where things go from here. Because then you have the whole Rebecca and Big Jim, like, partnership kind of thing. And, you know, Katie, it's just so hard to like want to talk about this show, because I watched it and I was like, well, that was a thing I watched, because it got significantly less enjoyable for me after season one, to where I'm not really sure how they came to like any of these decisions. I still really like the whole Joe and Nori thing, because it was a very accurate teenagers dealing with chaos and feelings and all sorts of things.
And the love triangle with Melanie and Joe and Nori, like that was well done. Like, yeah, there are
and
parts
then Hunter
about this
too.
I really like. Oh yes, yep.
So you have that, and it feels very high school like without the high school setting. I mean, you have the school, but you know what I mean. They're not like going to school.
Right. There's no English class right now where you can pass notes.
Yeah. And then they find the crater to explore and stuff. And this is this after Angie dies?
Yes. Angie dies real early. I think in
the first episode. No.
Yep. Angie dies in the first episode. And then we find out it's Sam who killed her in like the fourth episode, I think. I mean, I think we find out as the audience in like the second episode, but the cast or the characters don't find out until a little bit later. And I remember finding that out and was like, I can see no logical or reasonable reason why he would do this. Like, and I still don't see why Sam would kill Angie.
Yeah, I have absolutely no idea. I think it was one of those things where they were like, we're going to do this because she died in the book, so she has to die in the show, but nothing's going to happen the same way. Because Dodie dies too. So they do give you a lot of the same deaths that the book gives you, just in very, very different ways. Although I will admit, not to say that I liked anyone's death, but Dodie's death was handled much better coming at the hands of Big Jim than I think Angie's was coming at the hands of Sam.
And it has, there's a reason.
Yeah. She found something out that Big Jim didn't want to get out, so he killed her.
Right, and it works.
That like, is I a agree. Motive.
And I think one of the best scenes in that season is when Dodie comes back to haunt him.
Yes, love that.
That, I was like, oh, this is great. And that actress is just so perfect. She's so good at being that tauntingly vindictive. So I was like, okay, this is a good change. But yeah, it really starts to go nuts from about episode 6 or so on, when Barbie somehow gets outside the dome. What the fuck?
Yeah, and in the season finale for this one, you have, it's actually Rebecca who kills Pauline by giving her the morphine overdose, and Big Jim takes Andrea prisoner and kills her and attacks Julia, and so much happens in one episode. It's like you'll have this kind of lull where they're kind of just exploring and doing things, and Julia's kind of doing her reporter thing, and then all of a sudden everything needs to happen in the same episode. Yep. And you're like, wait, what?
This is too much all happening at once. You didn't, and here's the thing that I have a problem with that I see more in movies than TV, it's like you didn't earn any of this. You just kind of put some info in there and expected it to work, but none of it, especially by the end of that season, feels earned. It's all kind of, oh, okay, this is happening now, and now this is happening, and now we're doing this. And it was like, what?
Season 2 is where I was like, okay, maybe they can save this. Maybe. And then they go in the complete opposite direction, because if a show is only going to be 3 seasons, maybe you introduce some major characters in season 3, but I feel like by then, most of your characters should be established so that anyone who comes in doesn't need like this whole backstory that's going to take multiple episodes, and season 3 of this does exactly what I just said I wish it didn't do, because it introduces Eva Sinclair and Christine Price, played by Mark Helgenberger, who, as we know from the Tommyknockers, is apparently only allowed to be in Stephen King Alien adaptations.
Yes. Yep. And if I don't say it now, I might not remember. But God, does this have a lot of feeling of the Tommyknockers. Like that, the end, the like the last third of it, where the town has just gone nuts and everything is weird and crazy and obviously coke fueled. If you know the story of the book, and this feels like that, where it's, we're just gonna throw everything at the wall and see what sticks.
I was like, oh no, Marg, you did it again.
Yes, exactly, and like so they really had to change it, because like, in the book, the aliens are a small, tiny little end section of this. And in this, the third season is where the alien stuff really ramps up to 15. 20.
Everybody's an alien.
Everybody's an alien. And like, they do the horrible thing that TV shows do, where it's like, oh, this is happening. No, no, it was all a dream. It was all a dream. And it's like, well, what? And then that they brought in a character from Barbie's dream who we have not seen before, and then plays a huge role in like the finalizing of the series. I was like, where are you getting this from? How are you doing this?
I understand us not really seeing Sam until season 2, because he was very clearly staying away from the town. But to have Eva and Christine, you know, just show up, they have to then backtrack and kind of what felt like retroactively explain why we didn't see them for the first 2 seasons. And, you know, even Lyle, who doesn't appear in season 1, if I'm not mistaken, it's like, okay, well, him and Sam seem kind of like these weird guys who maybe don't want to hang around people a ton. And you can kind of explain it that way. Like, this is why we have not seen these characters until season two. But then to wait another entire season to introduce, like, these two characters who play a pivotal role, you're just like, okay.
You could have at least, like, dropped them in the background or had them at the diner. Something so that it doesn't feel like the writers are scrambling, because that's what it starts to feel like, is that they're scrambling to come up with explanations and to keep the story constantly driving forward. Because this show really tries to maintain a very intense momentum. And it does not succeed. It tries by having lots and lots of things happen. But it's like, well, when a problem comes into the show on one episode and then is resolved by the end of the episode, it's very hard to get invested in it. It's like, you can do that with something like Star Trek. Like, Star Trek is Monster of the Week or Problem of the Week or something, where really it's about the longevity of this cast and seeing how these people who you know are reacting to all these different scenarios. With this, it's like, yeah, you haven't set up these people well enough for that. And this is not a situation that... We are not traveling through the galaxy going to different planets. We are in one small town dealing with a dome issue here. And they just try to treat it like a Monster of the Week show and a serial. And that does not work. There's just too many moving pieces, and they're never able to really make it gel as a one cohesive story.
And let's explain the plot of this season a little bit.
You do that. You explain the plot of this.
You mentioned the dream part, and that happens because they decide to go out through the way that they found under the dome and, you know, get to freedom. And then it's like they live a full year of their lives in this dreamlike state, and then you find out that the people who are outside of the dome are actually in the dome in cocoons, and you're just like,
pod people.
Okay, what? How did we get here? And this season requires so much hand holding and explanation that I just did not care for it, because what the problem is with seasons 2 and 3 is that they can't just show you things. They have to tell you. And if you're going to have a story be adapted into a visual medium, I feel like they should be able to show more than they tell.
Right. We should not get the level of info dumps that we get in this, because it's, and that betrays a serious weakness in the writing staff. They're not able to plant the seeds early enough that make it so that we don't need that explanation when the seeds bloom and the stories and that aspect of the story comes into play. And sometimes that's okay, but it happens all the time in this show, and it becomes really, really tedious. Like, even in the first season, they have first minute and 10 seconds of every single episode is a recap of what happened. And I was just like, ugh. Shut up. I shouldn't need this. If I'm watching this show, I shouldn't need to be reminded of all the crazy shit that happened last week, because I should be so invested that, like, I know what happened and I should want to watch it. And so it feels like a crutch that the writers and the production staff use to, like, oh, well, maybe we can pull in a little more audience if they just watch this little intro. And then the intro, by the time you hit the third season, is in no way helpful.
And there's like twice as many characters that they introduce, because then we're dealing a lot more with Hector Martin, Dr. Marston, and you have Lily appearing because she kind of takes over for Hunter. And, you know, she's kind of running the tech things outside the dome now that Hunter's in the dome. And it's just so much. Given that these aren't even like 20-something episode seasons, these were all 13 episodes because it was a summer series. So the summer series were shorter because they weren't the fall and spring shows. And what I think went wrong, well,
one of the things.
There are quite a few things that went wrong with the show, but I think it just tried to do way too much with seasons 2 and 3. It's like, if you want to follow the bring someone back from the dead thing and have that be tied to the egg, okay, do that. But then you throw in the cocoons and she's like the one getting them all in the cocoon. It was just way too much. It should have been like, you know, they find out the egg powers the dome. They destroy the egg, or, you know, they kind of still go through with that whole storyline. And then maybe Melanie starts acting strange or something, and they have like this whole mystery to figure out because the dome hasn't retracted. And now they have this person who died, you know, 40 years ago, 30 years ago, whatever it was, 70s or 80s. And right. I think adding more mystery to it with less sci-fi would have been the way to go.
Right. Yeah. It's like you can't rely on the sci-fi. Like you cannot rely on the sci-fi to be the thing that captures people. You have to have an interesting story. Like we'll use a really basic example here. We're talking about Alien, the original Ridley Scott Alien. Like the fact that they're all hiding from the alien queen and they're slowly dying and stuff. Like it doesn't really necessarily matter that she's an alien queen. It could be anything that is this overwhelming hiding presence. But the real story there is Ripley's growing understanding of her own strength and her ability to fight this thing and her determination. And that's the thing that drives people. And that's the thing that keeps your interest in the film. And they don't have any of that basis. It's all kind of like, oh, look at this magic thing that we have. Because, you know, when you're talking sci-fi of this level, it's really magic, aliens, two halves of the same coin. And so I think that's a big part of why the third season really falls down, is because they start to rely more and more heavily on the sci-fi concepts as opposed to the story itself.
Yeah, a lot of the season three plot is, hey, we need to brainwash all these people so they do what we want.
Yep. Yep. And, you know, that's just not very interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, Stephen King wrote an episode or two or three or something throughout this show, but you can't even blame him for this one.
No, I mean, what are you going to do if you're coming in as a writer of one episode or two episodes? Like, even if you're the author of the original work, you still have to work within
what they've already created.
Right, within the frame of what you have. He can't magically fix it. And when you're writing for a TV show, and like if you're writing like a script for a film or something, you have to stay within the guidelines. Your stuff has to be approved. You can't just write whatever you want and they'll film it. You write it, you send it into them, they do edits, and it's a back and forth. It's a very multiple people process of coming up with this story. So I also don't blame him. And I get the sense from the interviews and stuff I read that he was like, oh, this was a missed opportunity.
Yeah, and it's not even one of those things where I didn't like the source material. Like with Tommyknockers or Dreamcatcher. And then you're like, okay, King, you went a little wild there. You know, yep. It's like, yep. No, Under the Dome was a very enjoyable book. You know, it had a lot of things going for it. It was probably still too long. Let's be honest.
Right. But it still keeps you going.
Yeah. I was interested the whole time. It wasn't like the Tommyknockers where it felt like a slog to get through it. And that was shorter, I think, than Under the Dome. But, you know, this show kind of felt like how it felt to read Tommyknockers.
Yes. Yep. And in the same way of like, because there's a lot of things wrong with the Tommyknockers, a lot of things that are bad. And I'm sure Stephen King could probably elucidate far more than we can all the things that are wrong with it, because I know that's his personal like most hated book that he's written.
Yeah,
because that book also really relies on the sci-fi to tell the story as opposed to the story telling the sci-fi, and this makes all of those same mistakes, especially in regards to the kinship, which is the aliens. And oh my, like it just doesn't end up working because it's so overly complicated. And I think that's why the little bit of sci-fi that there is in the book, outside of the dome itself, of course, really works, because it comes down, you know, in that final scene between Julia and the aliens, it comes down to an emotional understanding between two beings. It's not about that they're an alien species. It's just trying to connect so that they can understand the dome dweller's perspective. And in this, like these, there's nothing to relate to with the kinship. They're just very flat, evil alien people.
And one of them is Barbie's daughter.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, that who grows from an infant to a full grown woman in
5 days.
Yeah. Oh, that was. Ooh, that was, I think, the most egregious thing for me was like, okay, because it's such a cheap shortcut.
Yeah.
To try to forge this false relationship with Barbie and her to try to make him her minion.
In like the last 3 episodes too. And you're just like, why are you doing this? And then, you know, we have what I would call a Stephen King fashioned epilogue.
Oh God, yes.
With the 1 year later scene at the very end there. And, you know, they've all moved on. Nori's in the army. She finds Joe in like kind of like a holding cell.
Yeah, like the worst holding cell that apparently has no bathroom.
Yeah, because they're all asleep and not awake. So clearly they don't need food or water or anything.
Right, they'll be fine. They'll just exist. It's cool. And there's no IVs or anything like that to indicate that they're still, you know, people. We're dead, just fine. Yeah, that part was just the final episode, like, to a certain extent, I was just like, wow, you really didn't know how to end this. Because it just like the dome comes down for no like
discernible reason.
I mean, it is because Joe does the thing with amethysts or whatever. But it feels so arbitrary that this is the final point, you know, not the breaking of the egg or any of the other things that happen. It's so arbitrary and requires a sacrifice of this, you know, very sympathetic, beloved character from the who's been with us for all 3 seasons. And then in the end, like, just kidding, he's still alive. And Don is still alive, you know, the bad guy.
Yeah.
And it was like, ugh.
And Big Jim is a congressman.
Yep. Which, that to me, I was like,
that tracks, at least.
That's, yeah, yeah. And I did like that final scene with Big Jim before he gathers the remaining, what do they call them? The resistance, the remaining members of the resistance other than Nori. I like that scene with him where he's talking to the government official and he's like, how do I make this work for me? And I was like, okay, that is the character that I've been wanting to see.
Yeah. And we see him for 10 minutes, maybe, if that.
Yep. And then we get to see him as the congressman. And like, then he's back to being like this quote unquote complicated character. And it's just so, it just feels kind of tacked on, as a lot of people complain about Stephen King's epilogues. It's like, and it feels, as since it's a TV show, it feels very much like a bid for like, give us another season. We can always do another season, folks. We just need the funding. And that's what the showrunners said. Was like, well, I was pretty happy with where we left it. But, you know, we left it open in case somebody wants us to make more. I was like, nobody wants you to make more, sir. Nobody. Even no. The most dedicated fan of the show can't possibly want you to make more.
Yeah, yeah. You know, to be honest, I did not expect us to go an hour on this.
No,
so we clearly had a little more to say than we each thought. But, you know, they made this show a lot more complicated than it needed to be. Sometimes shows can be simple, you know?
Yes.
I feel like if you're going to adapt Under the Dome, maybe it needs to be a little more like, I don't want to say Stranger Things necessarily, but it feels kind of like that small town vibe, but something weird is happening. And I think Stranger Things does that way, way better than this show does.
Right. I think for this story to succeed, you need to go deeper, not wider. You need to dig deep into the relationships between all of these people in the town and have those tense moments between them make up the majority of the drama, rather than blood is raining from the sky, which happens in this, which is just real special.
All the fish are ruined.
Yep, all the fish are ruined. And then we just add a little something to the lake and then everything's fine again. It's cool. Don't even worry about it.
And windmills and all sorts of things going on. I just thought it was way too much. Like, they tried to give the dome a life of its own that it did not need.
Yeah, we just didn't need that. Because it's much more upsetting and concerning when it's not malicious.
Yeah.
It's much scarier when it is like, it doesn't care. It's not it can't care. And it will not listen to your pleas. It will not give you grace or benevolence. it's just a thing and you just have to deal with it like a locked door. And that's much scarier to me because you can't reason with it. You can't predict its actions. You can predict its actions, but through that prediction, it's even more terrifying because you know you can't change it.
Yeah, and the whole red cellar door thing that we didn't even mention, to get back into the dome, it's just like, this is so far off from the source material. And it's one thing to take the source material and make something that is still entertaining, much like Kubrick did with The Shining.
Or Dr. Sleep.
Yeah.
Like, I would say Dr. Sleep is a much better example, not of The Shining, but a better example rather than this, of somebody who took the original material and really changed and adapted it to be something else.
But it's still close to the source material.
Right, right. And I think that's why it works, is because it just kind of, or like...
Mike Flanagan treated that as an adaptation of both Dr. Sleep, the book, and as a sequel to Kubrick's movie.
Right. And I don't think anybody else could have done that successfully.
Yeah, because I just read that book, actually, and obviously I'll be doing an episode on this soon. But as I was reading through the book, I was like, okay, there are definitely a lot of things that they got right with the movie adaptation. And I could see that as I was reading the book, having seen the movie. And obviously I've forgotten some details, but it's like the connection with, you know, Dan and Abra and Rose the Hat. It's like that all felt very genuine and kind of came across really well in the movie adaptation. Whereas this, a lot of the relationships were shifted so much that even those didn't come across the same way. And you're just like, okay, sure, Barbie and Julia ended up together, but he still killed her husband.
And she just glosses over that. She's mad for like 20 minutes and is like, meh, whatever. He was a douche anyway. It was like, but you were so worried about him before. Like,
and he had a baby with someone else.
Yes. Yes. It all conflicts with each other, like the character motivations and the character actions and then the story motivations. It all just kind of, it just feels exhausting at a certain point. Like if you watch, like, because I would binge watch this. And it was like, okay, can't handle anymore. Can't handle any more twists and turns. Don't have any more space in my brain to keep track of all these different story changes.
And there were so many different storylines to keep track of all at once, too.
Right, which is in the book, too. But the storylines in the book all seem to very well lace together. In this, they feel like parallel, like you're running down a 16-lane highway. And there's 16 different stories going on, and you've kind of got to peek in on all of them.
Yeah, one thing we didn't even mention either, and I want to just kind of wrap this up soon here, because I think we've gone on much longer than maybe listeners expected to at this point.
Yes.
But the Fight Club ring.
Oh, God. That thing.
And with Max, and I was just like, okay, wait, who hasn't Barbie had a relationship with in this town now?
Yes, and then the Max's mom thing, being on an island out there. Yeah. They're apparently,
although love Mare Winningham.
Oh yes, definitely, she's a great actress. But the just like things just happen, and that was definitely one of those things that just happened, that was like, so the people in this town are just gonna fight each other? Like, that doesn't make sense.
Willingly?
From anything I from anything I know about small towns, like they took the metaphor that's in the book literally, and that didn't work. It's like, not, these people aren't going to have a literal fight club over some beer. Like, that's just,
it was wild.
Not how it's going to work out.
Yeah. Do we even want to rate this? I think I might be a little generous and give it a 2 out of 5 because I did like season one.
I think I'd give it a 1.5 out of 5 just because it was so, I couldn't predict what was happening. And that's, like, I watch so many movies and TV shows that I can usually call it. Like, oh, that character's going to do this. And then sometimes I could do that with this show. But then other times, nope, not at all. Things happened that I was just like, what the hell? So just for the sheer, like, craziness and off the wallness, like, if this was a movie, this would be one of those good bad movies where it's like, but it goes on too long as a show to be that, where it's like, okay, you really tried and you really wanted to make something good, but you just did not know how to do it, how to pull it off.
I feel like this needed to be a one season limited series. The pacing was all over the place.
Maybe 15 episodes. Or, like, you probably could have condensed it down further than that, but it would have needed to be much more decisive and much more character focused in order for that to work, rather than setting up all of these different events to happen that then drive the characters forward. We need the characters to drive the story.
Yeah, maybe make it a one season, 16 to 18 episode season.
Yep, yep. And with a good editor, they could probably do a 10 episode limited series or whatever. But yeah, it was just like, they needed more boundaries, mm-hmm. I think. They needed someone to set guidelines of, like, this is what we're going for. This is how many episodes we have. Because if you just leave it open-ended, this is definitely the kind of story that can become, and no judge to fans of the show, this can become kind of Supernatural or The Vampire Diaries type thing, where we'll just stretch this out as long as we can until it becomes so far-fetched that it's just absurd.
And sometimes if a show is absurd from the start, it works. Like DC's Legends of Tomorrow, in my opinion. That yes. was wacky from the start. It worked. I watched, I want to say, the first three or four seasons of Vampire Diaries and then was like, I don't care or understand. So I stopped that. But Under the Dome felt very much the same way. I was just like, I don't know if I would have finished it if it weren't for this podcast.
Yeah, there's just too much. It's too much that happens that you can't even. And I think the biggest frustration I had with the characters, and I brought this up with Junior, is how they change on a dime.
Yep.
And so you can't ever predict what a character is going to do. And you can't really get to know them because they change for whatever the story needs them to. And that's never a good thing. Unless it's, you know, Loki. You could do that with Loki because Loki's an opportunist. But for the average person, like, they need to have a consistent driving force and a morals and all of that. And none of the people in this have that. They're just kind of like, oh, I guess I'll go do this now. It felt really disappointing, honestly, because I really loved the book and I was like, this could make a really interesting show if you like, because The Mist, the movie of The Mist, fantastic.
Yeah.
And you could do that with this story, but they just did not at all.
They really, really did not. But Katie, thank you so much for joining me to talk about this. Like I said, we didn't go super in depth, but we still managed to go over an hour. So
hey. Well, thank you for having me. And I'm glad I got to talk about it with you. We always seem to talk about the worst of King.
That seems to be a theme. Yes.
It's fun.
All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.